Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, the third one of the morning. It's an early rise in Los Angeles, but this is a popular one. It's a Doc Talk podcast hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend, Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, promoting and producing it in Los Angeles. 347-205-9631. If you missed this, catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me, let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. First of all, the threes, Doc, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you bring in the double duo of the Varicellos boys back in here again, my friend. I will man the boards till the 10:55 mark.
All right, very good. We'll do that. I know you've had a busy morning this morning with all these prior broadcasts, but thank you, Mark, for taking care of ours today also. I'm doing fine. The show's doing fine. You know, we had an off week last week. We're getting back into the swing of things. You know, it's a Mother's Day weekend here in Pittsburgh. It's a little bit cloudy, a little bit chilly, but no snow. So that's always good. You know, our topic today, let me just go back to getting a hold of me, which I think you know how to do. GJRMD 308 at outlook.com. Today's topic, I've had a lot of interest in it, you know, a lot of emails, and it's something that's called carpal tunnel syndrome. And we're going to talk about it and define it, talk about what the carpal tunnel is, you know, what's in the carpal tunnel. I do have two experts, and, you know, we have two excellent points of view here. We have the Varicella doctors. We have Dr. Chris Varicella, who is a board-certified family doctor, sports medicine, does a variety of excellent treatments for his patients. And then we have the surgical brother, Dr. Matt Varicella, who does a tremendous amount of surgery. Excellent surgery with excellent results. Both men are actually world class. And indeed, it's a pleasure to have them on the show. Quite an honor. Matt, good morning. How are you?
Great, Greg. It's a good morning out here in Pennsylvania. We got some decent weather. Super friend of the show. I always love being on, so it's definitely a pleasure again.
Thank you. Christopher, good morning. Are you with us also, Chris?
I am here. Thanks, Greg. Glad to be here. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. And, yeah, excited to talk about this very common problem that people encounter very often.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, as far as the topic, carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, I've had several emails over the last couple of weeks about different topics. This one, you know, in patients and listeners emailing me. And this one in particular kind of struck me interestingly, where we have a middle-aged female. And by the way, carpal tunnel from our research is more of a female entity than a male entity, where we see females are prone to this, maybe 3 to 4 to 1 over males. And Mark, do you find that to be true also?
Yeah. Yes, I do find that to be true. Yeah, that's definitely something that is when all the papers come out, they always kind of comment on that. And I also see that in practice as well.
All right. And, you know, just going on with we have a middle-aged female had pain in her left palm. And she had been to from the email, 2 or 3 different specialists. She didn't identify which kind of specialist, but my thinking was somewhat orthopedic or neurologic. Had virtually no testing. The other puzzling thing, she had no actual physical examination. And the doctors that she had been going to had told her it was in her neck. The pain, the numbness in her palm was all in her cervical area. and she really had no problems with the cervical area and was just wondering, you know, shouldn't someone have examined me? Aren't there any diagnostic tests to help me? And she goes on that progressively she's losing the strength in her left hand. She can hold things but starting to fumble. So I thought it was a very interesting situation, and, you know, it rang a bell in my head that maybe she has carpal tunnel. And, you know, Chris, can I start with you on this? You know, what do you think that should have been done for this lady? Now, she's had no definitive therapy, but indeed, you know, they're telling her it's her neck, nothing more local, you know, into the arm, the palm, the wrist area. And, you know, the puzzling thing is nobody examined her. So, Chris, can you carry the ball?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Greg. So this is a very common complaint that we see in our practice, myself and my brother, and general orthopedic practice, but also in general practice, family medicine, and general practitioners see this often too. And as you mentioned, Greg, that a physical exam is extremely important paired with a history. And so we've talked about this before, but
yes,
just ascertaining from the patients, you know, where their symptoms are, what provokes them or what brings them on, what makes them worse, what can potentially make them better. And a physical exam is essential to also head you in the right path with the diagnosis. So typically with carpal tunnel syndrome, your physical or your history, let's start with the history. Your history is a female, most likely. It can be a variety of different age groups, but usually middle-aged. Sometimes there's pregnancy associated, sometimes there's diabetes associated, but it's numbness and tingling in the thumb, index, middle, and half of the ring finger. And then,
say
as you
again,
mentioned,
please,
in this
Chris,
patient, yes, it's in your
Chris,
thumb.
Say that again.
Your thumb, your index, your middle, and half, the thumb half of your ring finger are where the carpal tunnel nerve innervates and then also gives them symptoms when there's issues. And part of that nerve also, the carpal tunnel nerve, also innervates the big muscle at the base of your thumb. It's called the thenar muscle. And you mentioned your patient had problems with dropping things or dexterity issues, essentially. And that can come from irritation of the nerve. And so the nerve that gets irritated in the carpal tunnel is a nerve called the median nerve. And that gets compressed in the carpal tunnel, which is a structure, a tunnel, at the base of your palm and your wrist. So if you turn your palm up to the sky and you look at it and you see the bottom of your thumb and the bottom of your pinky and right where your wrist crease is, that's where the carpal tunnel is. And it's an area where tendons and this nerve called the median nerve go through. And through a variety of different reasons, repetitive overuse type of activities, age, you know, gender, diabetes, that nerve can get pinched and give you symptoms of dexterity problems, numbness and tingling, and things like that. There are some certain physical exam findings that you can provoke or elicit symptoms of carpal tunnel. And then there's also some testing that can be done. We call it electrodiagnostic testing or EMG and needle conduction, where the nerves and the muscles are stimulated. And what's checked with that is how quickly the nerves respond to stimulation from external. And if there's a delay in response, then we know there's a problem with that nerve sending its signals and then giving symptoms. So to answer your question, kind of long-winded, and then to break it down, Greg, there's some physical exam findings, history findings, and then also some advanced testing that can be done to really shed light on the issue for the patient that we were just describing.
Beautiful. You know, Chris, let's break that down just a wee little bit. You know, with regard to, you know, the entity carpal tunnel, could we describe what that means to our listeners? You know, we know that there's a bony floor, there's ligaments. You know, what is the tunnel about? And also importantly, what goes through the tunnel? You know, what are the structures? Are there motor nerves as well as sensory nerves that go through the tunnel? Are there blood vessels there? You know, can you give me a little more specifics on what goes through that tunnel? Can you help me there?
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. So the carpal tunnel, like I mentioned, if you look at your wrist crease as you flex and extend your wrist or move your wrist around, on the palm side, if your palm side's facing up to the sky, if you look in that area, right at the bottom of your hand and the base of your hand and the wrist, that's where the carpal tunnel lies. What travels through the carpal tunnel?
How big of a structure are we talking about?
So the width or the carpal tunnel is a tunnel-like structure that's bordered by bones on either side and the floor, as well as a ligament called the transverse carpal ligament going above. And really, if you look at the diameter of your wrist, it essentially traverses the diameter of your wrist. It's kind of an ovoid-like structure. It's variable in shape and width in patients, and sometimes there's a genetic predisposition to having a small carpal tunnel and then maybe leading to more carpal tunnel-like symptoms. But what goes through that is really everything that can move your fingers and your wrist and your hand. And so there's tendons that actually flex those fingers. So if you make a fist, those tendons that allow your fingers to flex into your palm travel through that carpal tunnel. There's vasculature or blood vessels that travel through that carpal tunnel. There's a nerve, a major nerve that we just mentioned called the median nerve that has, you touched on motor and sensory. It has both components to it. And when we talk about a nerve that has motor components in medical terminology, motor or motion, and so it innervates muscle, and then sensory actually, just as it sounds, provides sensation. And the median nerve that travels through this carpal tunnel is a mixed nerve that actually provides motor function, movement function, as well as sensation function as well. And so that's why symptoms of a pinched or irritated or issue with that carpal tunnel nerve can provide both of those things, trouble with functioning of the hand, as well as trouble with sensation.
Beautiful. I mean, beautiful explanation. Chris, is there a sequence of events, you know, overall, as they start having a symptom, is it more the sensation, the paresthesia, the tingling, or is it more of a motor loss to start with? How does that work, or is everybody a little bit different?
Well, everybody's a little bit different, but typically what happens is transient, or, you know, medical terminology, we use the word transient, but what that means is comes and goes, paresthesias or numbness and tingling in the tips of the fingers. And the fingers that I mentioned were the thumb, the index finger, the middle finger, and the thumb side of the ring finger. And that's typically what kicks off the symptoms, and they come and go. And usually you're not seeking medical attention until those symptoms become persistent and they don't go away. And then as the disease progresses, then you start to develop typically more trouble with functioning of the hand, picking things up. People complain about being unable to button their shirt, or, you know, the fine motor skills, as we call them, you know, manipulating fine, small things with their hand. They drop things, you know, they can't hold a glass, you know, that type of stuff.
Wow. No, excellent explanation. I'd like to go to Matt for a couple here. Matt, you know, again, with regard to, you know, Chris gave us an excellent explanation anatomical on what's going on. Is it true also that these symptoms are worse at night than they are during the day, and they can alter your sleep, or is that an old wives' tale?
No, that's a great question, Greg. And then obviously my brother had a great summary. That was very well done. So night pain and night numbness and tingling tends to be, at least in my practice when I see these patients, that is the most common reason that someone will come into the office. Because once it starts disrupting the sleep, then that decreases the quality of life. And that is typically...
Sure.
We see that a lot of times in orthopedics, for example, with shoulder pain, rotator cuff tears, patients are going to come in once it really starts disrupting their sleep. One of the treatment options, and this kind of gets into that part, is you wear a night splint, and it's actually a cock-up wrist splint. And what it'll do is it actually takes the wrist and extends it a little bit. So when my brother did that great review of the anatomy, when the wrist is in a little bit of extension, so if you're kind of looking at your wrist from the side, if you take your palm and kind of bend at the wrist joint and you kind of bend it down towards the floor, that's flexion And if you kind of tilt it back up and try to get your palm to face up towards the sky, that's the extension position. When you're in that slight extension position, it actually takes some of the pressure off of that carpal tunnel. Now, that tunnel-like structure, that's if you think of it, just like a tunnel that you'd see on the road, really it's a confined space. So these
like
anatomical structures, the flexor tendons that are moving the fingers and the nerve and those blood vessels, if you put your wrist into that slight extension position, actually alleviate some of that pressure. The most common reason that people are going to get the symptoms of that compression of the nerve is because there's inflammation in that joint lining tissue that creates swelling. And again, we're talking about that confined space. That a confined space doesn't like to be under that swelling, and that's what manifests
pressure.
As the symptoms of that numbness and tingling in those fingers that my brother had described.
Got it. And, you know, with regard to, you know, a couple, I wanted to spend a little time on more symptoms here, but then talk about even the lining of the median nerve can get inflamed and get damaged so that overall we tend to have progression of symptoms, correct? And, you know, they have an impaired conduction of the nerve when the anatomical structures seem to get damaged. You know, with regard to, again, our case, if I can, Matt, we're talking, this gal had numbness and pain in her palm. She had a little bit of wrist pain. You know, the hand overall was a little bit sore. But overall, there was no pain, you know, in her forearm. There was no pain in her neck. How did they come up with the fact they thought it was cervical root without examining her? You know, how did they come up with that diagnosis?
Yeah. Well, Greg, we always talk about the pillars of medicine.
Yes, sir.
It starts with that really strong history, all the stuff we're talking about. Maybe it's a middle-aged female who works at a desk and she's constantly taking her wrist back and forth with the mouse or, you know, answering phones a lot. And that hand and wrist is really kind of rotating and moving back and forth. The interesting thing about this case, and unfortunately for this patient, is there was no physical exam. You always have to pair the history with a comprehensive and thorough physical exam. So sometimes, you know, orthopedic surgeons or, you know, physicians, we get really busy in the office. And unfortunately, you know, you kind of sometimes every once in a while, there's a patient where they come in and, you know, they really don't get that thorough physical exam. I always tell my patients, you know, advocate for yourself. If you feel like, you know, that something wasn't done, speak up and say, you know, well, you know, why are you suggesting that it's my neck? I'll tell you, in my practice, anybody that comes in with wrist pain or numbness or tingling or even, you know, hand pain, I'm always doing a thorough physical exam from the head neck area down through the shoulder and elbow and wrist. Because now if this patient was told that she has neck issues, there are different physical examination maneuvers that can elicit maybe there's a pinched nerve at the neck. And a lot of times this would manifest as an I always tell my patients, it's kind of like an electrical shock that shoots down the arm when the neck is put in this position and, you know, the examiner kind of elicits this test, bring on that symptom. So a lot of times these can go hand in hand. Some patients can have carpal tunnel syndrome, and they can also have a pinched nerve in the neck, or the nerve could be maybe pinched somewhere in the forearm. And that's something that we call double crush, because meaning the nerve is actually pinched in two different spots, and that could lead it to be more susceptible. So if your nerve is pinched in your neck, that makes the nerve more vulnerable at the wrist, and those patients are predisposed to having carpal tunnel on top of the neck issue.
Wow. And so it can be a complex issue. But I think, you know, both you and Chris did mention, you know, our four pillars, you know, the history from the patient, the physical examination, diagnostic testing, then, of course, decision making. And, you know, we've been on the radio before with all this, Matt, and, you know, we want our patients to, again, be informed about what can be done, but they, you're right, have to be an advocate as well. Because sometimes the providers get extremely busy. Maybe they miss a step. But we want our listeners to be aware of what things do need to be done. And, you know,
yes.
Once we have our patient there, both you and Chris have listened to the patient. And, you know, you think, okay, I think we're, you know, thinking about different things. Can I ask you, what do you think about in a differential diagnosis? Are you thinking about a Raynaud's situation? Are you thinking just carpal tunnel? I think you mentioned could be a double whammy with the neck. What are the thoughts mm-hmm. going through your head here when someone says, you know, my hand's numb, my wrist is numb, I'm dropping things. You know, my other hand
yeah.
is starting to feel the same way. You know, what
yeah.
do you think about?
Well, exactly, and that's where, you know, you're going to pair that with the history. Maybe, again, they're repetitive, they're doing a position, maybe it's a male that's coming in running a jackhammer and they constantly have that vibration, they're in construction. So those start to kind of tip the bell start going off in your head, okay, maybe this is carpal tunnel. But, again, you start to kind of add these things up as they go along. Generic or kind of what we would call maybe non-specific wrist pain, a patient just comes in, and they're having wrist pain, carpal tunnel is always on my differential because not every patient is going to come in and go, I have numbness in these fingers. Now, that is
sure.
where what we would call as almost like an equivocal history where maybe some of the findings are consistent with carpal tunnel. Maybe it's arthritis in the wrist. So that's where you
yeah.
utilize that physical exam. And then also, and this is a little kind of gets back to that case, is some surgeons or physicians are going to be checking radiographs. Now, if you took 10 physicians and you pulled them and you said,
yes.
okay, somebody comes in, possibility of carpal tunnel, would you get wrist x-rays? Probably 5 of them would say yes, 5 of them would say no. And it's really, there are a couple different ways to go about that. If it's an equivocal case like this patient you're talking about, I absolutely would get x-rays just to make sure you're ruling out, like I said, arthritis in the wrist. You could find other causes of that wrist pain that the patient's having. And then a lot of times what I'll do in this situation is I'll get neck x-rays as well, too, to see if they have arthritis. Maybe there's some malalignment with the bones in the neck. And that starts to tip you off to say, well, maybe there's also an issue going on in the neck. Another one that sometimes comes up is maybe an MRI, especially if the patient's having months and months of problems and you've tried to have them go through the splinting and that didn't work. Then maybe check in for an MRI. You could find if there's, for example, sometimes people get carpal tunnel because they have a cyst that is expanding into that carpal tunnel confined area, and that's
right.
causing pressure on
mm-hmm.
the nerve. Now, the other part that I utilize in my practice, and I can't speak for my brother, but that is the EMG study. It's an electromyography,
yes.
and what that test is doing is it's testing
well, hey, Mark,
the muscles.
Matt, tell
yeah.
us what that
yeah.
test is before we talk about what it does. What does EMG mean? What does the test look like? What does the patient experience?
Yeah. So in
they
short,
know what x-rays are.
Yeah, exactly. So this test, if your provider orders that, that would involve you going to usually a separate location with a physician that is a nerve conduction expert, or sometimes it could be a physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor. A lot of times they're the ones that perform the test. You're going to go to this special testing suite, and usually the test is between 60 and 90 minutes, depending on all that needs to be done. And you're going to sit in the examination room, and it is a little uncomfortable. I haven't had one specifically myself, but I've, you know, talked to patients, and obviously I've seen physicians conduct the test. But it's they have to stimulate the nerve, so it does involve a little bit of, and I don't want people to get too grossed out, but it's a little
yeah,
bit of like pricking.
Yeah.
yeah, exactly. And so some patients do have some discomfort from that, but overall it's pretty well tolerated.
Is it
and,
like acupuncture?
Essentially, it could be considered similar to that. I'd consider
Got
that
it.
Kind
Go
of
ahead.
In the same group a little bit. And then, so what happens is the physician who's conducting the test is going to take you through that series and test the different nerves. Now, in my practice, I always order a bilateral comparison, meaning, so if you come in and my concern is your right side, I'm also going to have them do the left side so you have a normal, quote-unquote, normal comparison
exam,
because that helps you find
if there's some kind of, you know, even more subtle symptoms, you can compare it to that patient's normal side. Now, the reason this test can be very useful for the physician, again, getting back to this case, is that you can actually grade, are the symptoms mild to moderate? Is the nerve compromised in a mild fashion? Is it a moderate fashion, or is it a more severe fashion? And that can kind of tip the physician off to say, okay, maybe we need to intervene and, for example, try a steroid injection, or try, maybe they need to be given more consideration for surgery earlier on if the symptoms are more severe. And that's the point I did want to drive home, Greg, was that a lot of patients, and especially in our region where myself and my brother practice, things off for years. And so if you're in a situation where if you're looking down at your palm and you compare it to your other side and it looks like the muscles are different, meaning that the muscles are kind of wasting away, that's a situation where you really want to seek medical attention sooner rather than later, because the longer you put that off, I don't care how good the you get thenar atrophy. That's the fancy term for it. The longer you put that off, I don't care how good the surgeon is. The surgeon could do the world's best release possible, perfect release that goes perfect. But if that nerve function is already compromised, that's going to potentially affect the outcome, meaning that nerve actually doesn't recover. So one of the timelines that I'll say to my patients is, if you've really had these symptoms for over a year and they're debilitating, and if you get an EMG that shows that there's severe carpal tunnel syndrome, those are the ones that I push for sooner. Like, let's get you released because we want to make sure.
Let's hold off on that indication right now, if you don't mind, Matt.
Okay,
that's treatment. Yeah, we'll get there. There's no problem. You know what I wanted to do? We're going to go to the studio in L.A. But just, you know, with you and Chris, just kind of summarizing, you know, carpal tunnel. Typically, we have a dull, aching discomfort. Can be in our hand, maybe the forearm, even going up to the upper arm. It can be a tingling in the hand. It can be weakness or clumsiness of the hand. Also, sleep can make it worse. Sustained hand or arm positions can make it worse. Repetitive actions of hand or wrist can make it worse. You know, neither one so far have mentioned about changing hand position or shaking your hand, getting the symptoms to go away. Again, old wives' tale, old literature. Have you ever heard of that?
Chris, so from my standpoint, that I was saying shaking hands will make the symptoms go away?
Shaking the hand, so to speak.
Actually. Yeah, I thought you meant a shaking hand.
Greg, that's actually the most sensitive carpal tunnel diagnostic test we have from a system standpoint. It's called the flick sign. You shake your hand out trying to wake it up. And so that's actually that's one of the questions I ask patients. You're absolutely right about that. It's called the flick sign, F-L-I-C-K.
Beautiful. Excellent. Thank you for clarifying that. Hey, let's go to the studio, doctors. We have Mark Mancini there. He has several questions. Mark, you're in L.A. You're in the studio. How about giving us some questions from our listeners?
Okay. Russ from Olympia, Washington, basically says he notices when he wears tight shoes, halfway up his foot, there's pain. And usually when he gets a pedicure or something, they have to scrape that. It could be a bunion. It could be something. But it's usually halfway up his foot on his right side. What causes that? Is it the tightness of the shoes? Is it foot problems materializing now? Guys, I love this show. Keep up the great work.
Well, you know what? It's a little off topic today. But, Chris, can you give him any insight into that? I don't think we're talking about plantar fasciitis with that. But do you want to take a throw at it?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like plantar fasciitis. That sounds like it could be something like a bunion on the big toe side or a bunionette on the small toe side. If the shoes are tight, it could be compressing, you know, the foot and ankle.
Sure.
Sometimes you have some arthritis on the top part of your foot that if you wear tight shoes, the kind of the tongue of the shoe and how tight you tie the shoe can irritate that. But that would warrant some evaluation if it is troublesome. By a medical professional, just to shed some more light on that.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
Gail from Clearwater, Florida, talks about tennis elbow. She gets bursitis in her elbow sometimes. What causes that? Because it's like a bubble on the bottom side of her elbow. Oh, good question.
Yeah. Matt?
Well, yeah, that's a good one. And, again, it's interesting this caller talks about this because sometimes the symptoms of carpal tunnel, like we're talking about, and tennis elbow or something where we call flexor tendon irritation, that can occur at the elbow. And a lot of this stuff can be in the same picture. I'll do three different types of surgical procedures sometimes on one forearm, elbow, wrist area, depending on the pathologies. But what happens in that situation is it's, again, a repetitive motion thing. So, again, we talk about the wrist being in flexion versus extension.
Yes.
Tennis elbow at the elbow is obviously going to be caused by inflammation of those tendons that when you're bringing your wrist up into extension, again, palm towards the sky, that is actually irritating the tendons. And where they actually start is up at the elbow. And then they span all the way down to the forearm and into the fingertips. So when somebody's doing that, and this patient talks about a bubble at the wrist. Now, that's most likely associated to some swelling in the area. But if that's something that's persistent, I would say probably, at least start with your family physician and maybe get some x-rays to make sure there's no arthritis at the wrist, because that could also cause some fluid to kind of push out in that area.
Yeah,
a couple different things there.
Beautiful. And could it be any bleeding or anything like that? Or is it more of a tissue fluid bleb that's there, Matt? What are we looking at fluid-wise?
Yeah, most likely the latter, unless the patient is on blood thinners. So if somebody's on Coumadin or warfarin, for say they have like a prosthetic valve in their heart,
sure.
Those patients are a little more predisposed to having very thin blood that will bleed. That's going to be a little bit more of a less common situation, but more so the soft tissue inflammation.
Beautiful. All right, Mr. Mancini.
Let me take one more, and I'll get it back to you. This is another interesting one. Joey from Bucks County, PA, is a regular listener here. He said, I've heard the term of water in the knee. What does that mean? Because sometimes my knee feels inflamed a little.
Yeah.
Can you handle that?
So, yeah, absolutely. So water in the knee or water on the knee, that's a very common term that we hear. Matt would probably echo that as well in our office. And essentially what people are talking about from a medical standpoint, we call that something, what we call that is an effusion. And so what that means is there's swelling in the knee. Now, the swelling can come from a number of different things. The swelling can come from trauma. So if you actually have an injury to the cartilage or maybe the bone in your knee or have a ligament tear, a specific ligament tear like an ACL tear, there can be blood that actually bleeds into the joint, and then it causes a swollen-looking knee. More commonly, it's from overuse or a condition like arthritis in the knee, that if you use your knee a lot, those cartilage cells in the knee tend to secrete or expel more fluid, and then you get swelling on the knee, or like I said, the medical term is effusion. There's another entity called a bursitis in the knee, where the swelling is actually on top of your knee. It's the old term, or the lay term that we use for that is plumber's knee, where from friction on the ground, it can cause a little inflammation and a little structure on the top part of the knee called the bursa. And when that bursa gets inflamed, it can be swollen and actually look like actually you have water on your knee. And that's the lay term's called plumber's knee, or we call it in medicine prepatellar bursitis. But essentially, both those things can be evaluated by a physician or healthcare professional and give you a diagnosis and a treatment plan.
Yeah, Chris. Are there times they'll put a needle in there and take the fluid out? Does that indicate
that? If it's uncomfortable, causing a lot of pain, a lot of decrease in range of motion, it's really significantly swollen, what we'll do is we'll numb the knee with a little bit of an anesthetic like a lidocaine. And then we'll stick a needle in with a syringe, and we'll do something called aspirate or remove the fluid off the knee. And it can really change the symptoms in patients in terms of pain, discomfort, and lack of range of motion very quickly because we're actually physically removing that fluid off the knee. And then you're usually pairing that with something like a corticosteroid injection, a steroid shot, or a cortisone shot, how they're known. That really keeps the fluid away. So absolutely, Greg, you're right on with that.
Beautiful. No, thank you both. You know, Mark, I'll bring the show back here
okay.
to my studio. You know, as far as where we've been, doctors, you know, we've talked about what carpal tunnel is. We've talked about examination. We talked about physical findings. You know, with regard to then, if indeed we've made the diagnosis because we've listened to the history, we've examined the patient, we've done some testing diagnostically, we come up with, you know, carpal tunnel. Then maybe we look at, you know, what level of carpal tunnel is this to be? I'm getting into symptom or to treatment. You know, when do we use a splint? When do we inject? When do we put this at rest? When do we then go ahead, Chris, come to you for surgery, or Matt, come to you for surgery? Then what do we do for rehab? You know, after we've done this, how do we rehab the patient? So how about, Chris, do you want to start with that? You know, once you go ahead, you've made the diagnosis, what do you do
yeah.
for the patient at that point? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Matt had touched on this earlier. Patients typically are coming in when they're interfering with their activity, daily living, functioning, or interfering with their sleep. And so when those patients are coming in, we've made that diagnosis of the carpal tunnel. We have a discussion about, you know, mild, moderate, severe. If it's mild carpal tunnel syndrome, sometimes, as Matt mentioned earlier, a wrist splint is enough to really resolve the symptoms in these patients. Physical therapy is also an option for some of these mild symptoms where there's some physical therapy techniques where they'll kind of manipulate the tissue or put your hand and wrist and your head and neck in positions that actually stretch the nerve. They're called nerve glide stretches, where essentially that nerve is getting pinched in the carpal tunnel, and there's some physical physical therapy maneuvers that can be done to really resolve that pinching just from externally. Then as you get
Chris,
into the moderate and severe, yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, just, you know, along that, with excellent explanation, we're, time frame. You know, if we say, hey, it's mild, we want some PT, with like a splint, are we talking for a week? Do we say, hey, you're going to be laid up for 6 weeks? What's our range here of time that therapy needs to ensue to maybe get us back to proper physiology?
That's a great point, Greg. So typically what I prescribe with my physical therapy or my conservative treatments like bracing is 6 weeks. And so I'll give them
wow.
6 weeks of some physical therapy and a brace. But with the caveat where if they're really uncomfortable, you know, they can call and come back in for a reevaluation. But, you know, if you go in a brace for a week or two, typically you're going to know if that's going to help resolve your symptoms rather quickly.
Yep.
Same thing with physical therapy. For a week or two, you're going to know if, you know, the physical therapy, a couple of sessions of physical therapy, a couple of weeks or a couple of nights with the brace are going to help resolve your symptoms. But once you get outside of that time frame, then we're really talking about more invasive treatments. And then the next level
sure.
of treatment for either, we call it refractory or non-responding to our conservative treatments, mild carpal tunnel or moderate carpal tunnel, you can inject. And what we of anesthetic, like a lidocaine, and a steroid,
yep.
Cortisone shot.
And
there's a couple
Chris,
of different injection techniques. Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
But hey, Chris, where are you injecting? We'll talk
yeah.
about what you're injecting, but where are you injecting? Do you mind handling that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an important part. So there's a couple ways to do the injection. You're injecting really essentially at the wrist crease area. If you look at your wrist, you're injecting at that wrist crease that's probably closest to your wrist. There's
sure.
a way to do it where you actually can go in with a needle, not use any visualization, just kind of palpate the area with your hand as a physician and just inject into the carpal tunnel. Those that are experienced in doing those injections can get in the carpal tunnel quite easily. And what you inject is that mixture of steroid and lidocaine. And the steroid actually
okay.
decreases inflammation around the nerve and the tendons and can relieve symptoms for a significant period of time. A lot of times when you inject in a moderate level carpal tunnel, those symptoms are going to return. But injection may give some temporary benefit. And then another reason to use the injection is in a scenario where the diagnosis is not clear. I use this a lot in my practice where we use injection for two purposes, for diagnostic, meaning it helps with the diagnosis, and that means if the injection helps what we're treating, if your symptoms get better, then we know that's the diagnosis. If it doesn't, then we have to look elsewhere. And then therapeutic purposes is to actually fix the problem. And so other way to do the injection, and the way I do it, is I use an ultrasound machine. So a lot of people are familiar with ultrasound from a baby standpoint, where you scan the stomach and you find, you know, the gender of your child. But actually, in musculoskeletal and orthopedic medicine, we've been using ultrasound a lot to help aid in our diagnosis and treatment for patients. So there's a technique that I use with the ultrasound where I can actually visualize that carpal tunnel nerve, that median nerve, and I inject the mixture around the nerve and actually cover the nerve with the medicine and the numbing, and it actually provides a little better response because we're targeting specifically that area. But the injections happen at the wrist, and you can do it either with or without visualization, the ultrasound or not. And then as you progress, go ahead.
So just as far as, like, you're doing a great job, and I know you do it a lot. What I want to let our listeners know, when you're injecting, you know, whether it's a lidocaine, whether it's a steroid, the purpose is to go ahead and work in that tunnel and have the sensory nerves maybe get numb for us, but also decrease inflammation of the nerve covering so that we start to get symptom relief. I think that's what you were alluding to. Maybe sometimes they'll give us completely right, that's all. So the medicine, as you said, can be diagnostic but also therapeutic. Now, excellent. How much pain would the patient experience if they came to your office and you were going to go ahead and inject them? Is it something overall they would need sedated or basically, you know, take it like a man? How do you handle that?
That's a great point, Greg. So a lot of patients, as Greg mentioned, I do this a lot in my office, in my practice. Most every patient does extremely well. They don't need sedation. What I use is a little anesthetic on the skin, a topical skin refrigerant. It's a cold spray that numbs the surface of the skin. And then you use a small needle. It's a very tiny in diameter needle to go through that area. And then there's also the lidocaine or the anesthetic in the injection. So you don't need sedation. You can drive home after the injection. It is a little uncomfortable, but what patients kind of describe it as is kind of if you got your flu shot, you know, kind of a pinch and a burn is what it feels like most of the time, the description from patients. So it is very well tolerated. You don't need sedation, and it can be done right in the doctor's office. You don't need to go to the operating room. You don't need to go to a surgical suite. It can be done right in the office.
Wonderful. So there's no fear in that. If that would be, if their practitioner would say, we want to inject it. And, you know, as far as then, you know, I know we're running out of time here. With regard to, say, a next level of treatment, and maybe I can go to Matt for that, is say one is injected, but our patient's symptoms return, and they're really miserable. What would be the next level of treatment for this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I also wanted to just add one extra point to the diagnostic and potentially therapeutic part, because sometimes, and again, I like to kind of circle back to this interesting case with this patient who was sort of felt like she was being put off. In that situation, a lot of times, like my brother was mentioning, you would get an injection into the carpal tunnel, and that helps the physician decide, okay, it makes sense to potentially do the release or the surgical release, or maybe we got to look at other parts that are causing this wrist pain. Because if a patient has temporary improvement with the injection, that is a very good, we call it a prognostic indicator for that patient having success and resolution of the symptoms after the injection. And that kind of makes sense if you stand back and think about it. If we're injecting the carpal tunnel and the patient has no change in his or her symptoms, well, that almost mimics what you would do with the surgical release. You would release the carpal tunnel, get that nerve out from under compression. But if there's no response to the injection, that's kind of I tell my patients, that's like a mini trial run. Let's see how you do, and then it makes sense to move on with surgery. Now, this part we could talk about for probably, you know, a whole show, because there are various types of surgical approaches that you could do with this. And this ranges from something called an ultrasound-guided release, which actually my brother does. So even as a non-op primary care sports med doctor, he is able to do the ultrasound-guided release. So a lot of patients in our practice, they'll actually get that ultrasound-guided release. And compared to, say, the more quote-unquote old-school technique where you make a small incision right at the kind of the center of the base of that palm, like my brother was describing, most people, if you look down at your palm and your wrist is up, you know, the palm's facing up towards the sky, you have that crease right in the middle there. And that's typically where that incision would go. And again, I say it's old school because that, yeah, go ahead.
Matt, the incision would be what, an inch and a quarter long? Is that what we're talking about here?
About that. And it's, you know, whether it's, you know, a little bit bigger, and the caveat with there is that sometimes if a patient has a prior release and they already have an incision, or say they tried an ultrasound-guided or an endoscopic procedure where you use a scope and you just do a smaller incision, if the patient still has symptoms, sometimes you have to make that incision a little bit bigger and actually cross into the wrist crease and into the forearm, because the surgeon has to find that nerve and dissect it free from scar tissue. So that's kind of the spectrum there. But one of the most common reasons that a patient will have persistent symptoms afterwards is actually an incomplete release of the carpal tunnel. So that's something that's important for patients to know, because sometimes that incision, everybody's a little bit different in terms of their anatomy. The surgeon would have to make that incision as big as he or she needs to get that release performed successfully and make sure it's completely
and
done.
Matt, that can be determined at the time of the surgery, correct?
Yes.
What is 100%. Necessary there? And, you know, if I can just, excellent job on what we're talking about. You know, you mentioned about if there, this is a secondary procedure, that they maybe had a release, their scar tissue. Just for our listeners to know, and I think you know what's coming up, how do you prevent scar tissue the second time that they won't be in the same position? Can you help me?
Yeah, so I'll actually use a lot of times in my revision cases. So revision meaning they already had one surgery and then we're trying to repeat the release and free it from scar tissue. There's special biologic wraps, so to speak. If you actually look at them, some of them are made from amnion, but they actually look like saran wrap. If you're looking at if you're looking at it, just, you know, if you're familiar with
the
product. And yeah, exactly, as a product. And what the surgeon will do is after he or she's gone down and released the nerve from all that scar tissue, you wrap that nerve around that, then, and that helps prevent scar tissue from forming back around there. Now, when we talk about the outcomes on a secondary procedure as opposed to the first time it happens, most patients, you know, greater than 90% have significant resolution of their symptoms, especially if it's not a chronic situation with a lot of muscle wasting. In the revision, the secondary situation, you'll see that 25% have really good relief after it. 50% will say that they have, so half of people will say that they have some relief of their symptoms, and a quarter, so one in four, will actually say there's no difference in their symptoms. So that's why it's always, you know, in the surgical field, I always try to tell my patients, you know, we got one chance to do this right, and you really want to do it right the first time. So it's important to really see a thorough provider to work that up.
No, excellent. No, I think what you're saying is correct. And again, giving our people good information is you want to go to a good provider, a well-trained surgeon, someone that has a good reputation. Because you're right. I tell my patients the same thing. Let's do it right the first time. And, you know, we talked about a product called Amnion, not to push that product, but I use that same product to rebuild eardrums. And it's excellent. It's like a cellophane, but it does help build eardrums with very little scarring. So it's interestingly that you use it also internally around nerves to prevent scarring and improve conduction. And, you know, I think just to let our listeners know that, you know, overall both you and Chris do a carpal tunnel type of surgery. Chris, now you're doing yours in your surgery center. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And Matt had mentioned the longer incision and kind of the old school way, or the, you know, the original way to release the carpal tunnel. And so what happens is, we mentioned that carpal tunnel, and the ligament is essentially the roof of the tunnel, and that's the target of what we're treating.
Okay.
And you can dissect down to that ligament from the palm down or from the carpal tunnel up. And so the way I do it is I use an ultrasound machine to localize the contents of the carpal tunnel and then create a path using a needle to inject a numbing or an anesthetic into the area.
Sure.
And then I take a device that actually is inserted into the carpal tunnel and then releases from the bottom up using ultrasound.
Wonderful.
Now, the limitation of that technique is you need to really know what you're looking at with ultrasound. And that's something that's not every orthopedic or sports medicine physician would really know how to do that. But that's the limitation of that technique, is that you need good visualization. Also, another limitation is if you have a really, we call them meaty palms, or you have a big hand.
Yeah.
Sometimes ask the ultrasound to try to visualize deep in underneath that tissue if there's a lot of tissue there. But yeah, it's a very excellent treatment technique. It's a fast recovery. We do it in our practice, and like Matt had touched on, we do it both ways. We do it, you know, open, and we do it, you know, ultrasound guided. Results for patients to get back to their life faster.
And Chris, your patients are not put to sleep, are they?
Yeah, correct.
You do this with them?
I do it under straight local anesthetic without even any sedation. We talk through the procedure. Some patients watch, some patients decline watching.
Sure.
if they're a little scared of needles or things.
Yes.
Like that. But essentially, the procedure from start to finish takes about less than 5 minutes to do that full release.
Wonderful.
And they're out of our surgical suite in less than an hour. So,
and you know, based on, you are going to close an incision though, correct? With that, you will the incision closed.
Yeah. So it's variable. A lot of times we can rely on Seri-strips with how small the incision is. We make it right before you bend your wrist, right in that area. And I use a scalpel to basically make an incision in the skin. And I have to make a little bigger incision, maybe one or two stitches. But if I make my standard incision, usually we'll cover it with Seri-strips, which for the listeners are like little Band-Aids. And then we cover it with gauze, and usually within 3 to 7 days, that incision's healed up and they're good to go. So
beautiful. Well, let me go to Matt. Matt, your technique, your surgical venue, again, with this kind of a situation, how do you handle it? You know, are your patients anesthetized? Are they in the OR? Very similar?
It is similar. I actually let the patient decide. So the difference with the surgery center versus doing it in the operating room at the hospital is you have the anesthesiologist is there just in case. And so what I'll actually say to the patient in the office is I say, you know, if I get a sense that the patient has a little bit of anxiety about, you know, being awake for this, because you can even do that, the open incision in the base of the palm, you can do that under local. And I have patients that, you know, they elect to watch the procedure. They want to see it. It's not everybody, and I say that's the minority of people.
Sure.
But you can do it that way. And then if I get a sense, you know, maybe there's some anxiety there, we say, okay, you can get a little bit of anesthesia, get like a twilight, quote unquote twilight.
Sure.
Where, you know, you're kind of loopy, you're out of it, you don't really know what's going on. And in that case, the important part with that is that you just have to have somebody drive you. But if you get it under local, you can drive yourself home. And again, just like my brother was saying, even for that ultrasound guided release, which takes, you know, 5 minutes, the open procedure takes, you know, the exact same amount of time, like 3, 4, 5 minutes a lot of times.
Beautiful.
And then usually, even with that open incision, you can close it with glue so the patient doesn't have to get taken out, because sometimes that can be uncomfortable in the office. But just like a dressing for one day, and then let that glue kind of run its course. And then most people, even with that open incision, they heal it by about 2 weeks. And really, there's no restrictions afterwards at all.
Wonderful. You know what? Thank you. Let's go to the studio again. Mark Mancini, what do you have to finish up?
Yeah, let me get a couple in here because they've been bugging me on these. Robin coming in from Warren, Ohio, another regular listener. She basically goes, a great, interesting show. What foods should be avoided with carpal tunnel? Is there any?
Chris or Matt, do you have anything on that?
Yeah, I could jump in on that. So there's no foods that would be directly related to aggravating carpal tunnel. There are pro-inflammatory foods, meaning foods that create more inflammation. As we mentioned multiple times throughout the broadcast, that carpal tunnel is an issue with inflammation in the tunnel, creating lack of space. So pro-inflammatory foods or foods that are promoting inflammation are foods, processed foods, your refined sugars, your pops, your sodas, your processed foods, your fast food, high in fat content. Those foods are going to, the salty foods, those foods are going to promote inflammation, so then may aggravate carpal tunnel type symptoms, not directly, but like I said, through the inflammatory process that would happen. And conversely, the anti-inflammatory foods like deep sea fish and, nuts, and fish oil and turmeric, a spice called turmeric, those can be anti-inflammatory and may alleviate some symptoms.
So it's a matter of good nutrition, good healing, and avoiding things that would be somewhat provocative to slowing our healing down.
Absolutely. Like in any case, it holds true with carpal tunnel as well.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Manson. Hey,
Albert,
let
me get one more in here. Albert from Poway, California, comes in and he says, "What's the fastest way to relieve carpal tunnel? Is ice probably the best way?"
Chris,
Well, the fastest, I think the fastest way to if you're talking about anti-inflammatory and something you can do at home, would be buying a wrist splint over the counter and using ice, because the wrist splint's going to open up the carpal tunnel, as Matt had said earlier. If you use ice, that's going to decrease inflammation, getting to that anti-inflammatory effect. That's something you do at home. But if you do have these symptoms, it is important to get evaluated by a healthcare professional to really shed light on that. But, quickest in the office would be to do a cortisone shot or a steroid injection if you're intervening as a medical professional. I don't know, Matt, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just add Advil, Aleve, Motrin, as long as, you don't have any issues with your kidneys or some other reason why
liver.
You wouldn't be able to take, we call them non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So, if you go to Walmart, again, we're not promoting any sort of drugs, but Advil 2 is something that a lot of times is considered, and that's going to decrease the inflammation there. Like my brother was saying, in the mild cases, if this is something that has been going on maybe a couple months and it's starting to wake you up one night a week during your sleep, if you try those and you're still having symptoms or the symptoms are getting worse, you definitely want to come in and seek a healthcare provider just to get it checked out.
Excellent. We're going to wrap this up. What do you think, Mark Mancini?
And let me ask you, before, as we start to wrap it up with less than 2 minutes, somebody wants to get a hold of the Varicello brothers. How would they get a hold of these guys?
Chris, go ahead. How do we get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me. Email CV as in Victor, ARACALLO @gmail.com. Or our office number, if you're in the area, the central Pennsylvania area or beyond, 814-375-6200.
Yeah, and that's the same number for me, 814-375-6200. I actually like to post on Mark's webpage. I'll through my Facebook medium, I'll actually put in the comments there my information, because in the past when it's been said over the phone here, sometimes it gets misspelled. So I think sometimes people try to reach out to me and they can't. But mine's MAV as in Victor, ARAC as in cat, ALLO @phhealthcare.org.
So thank you, gentlemen. If I can, Mark Mancini, to summarize our case, the gal with the numb hand, thinking it was her cervical spine, nobody examining her. I want our listeners to know, as our guests have said, you want to talk to your provider. You want them to examine you. You want them to do diagnostic testing. That leads to a more correct diagnosis. That's what we'd like to leave our listeners with today. And if people want to get a hold of me, it is gjrmd308@outlook.com.
And I can't wait for next week, Dr. Greg Roscoe, where another great guest comes in. We're talking about chronic coughs and stuff like that. That's going to be an interesting show as well as this one. Special thanks to the Varicello brothers, Chris and Matt. Yours truly signing off in Los Angeles. Have a great weekend, everybody out there that listen to the show, and a safe and happy Mother's Day. Till next week.
Thank you, Mark. Mark, if I can, would like to have the Varicella brothers back on in about 2 weeks to talk about plantar fasciitis as well as robotic surgery. So we have some great topics coming up. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys, everyone. Okay. Have a blessed one.
Bye.